till those unprintable fiends got their claws on it. I'll leave just as soon as I deliver what I came to deliver. Galaxy, if it didn't involve a Selden crisis, I would leave right now.
Selden crisis? Indber exhibited first interest. Meese was a great psychologist. A Democrat, boor, and rebel, certainly, but a psychologist, too. In his uncertainty, the mayor even failed to put into words the inner pang that stabbed suddenly when Meese plucked a casual bloom, held it to his nostrils expectantly, then flipped it away with a wrinkled nose. Indber said coldly, "Would you follow me? This garden wasn't made for serious conversation." He felt better in his built-up chair behind his large desk from which he could look down on the few hairs that quite ineffectually hid Meese's pink scalp skin. He felt much better when Meese cast a series of automatic glances about him for a non-existent chair and then remained standing in uneasy shifting fashion. He felt best of all when, in response to a careful pressure of the correct contact, a liveried underling scurried in, bowed his way to the desk, and laid thereon a bulky, metal-bound volume. "Now, in order," said Indber, once more master of the situation, "to make this unauthorized interview as short as possible, make your statement in the fewest possible words."
Ebling Meese said unhurriedly, "You know what I'm doing these days."
"I have your reports here," replied the mayor with satisfaction, "together with authorized summaries of them. As I understand it, your investigations into the mathematics of psychohistory have been intended to duplicate Harry Selden's work and eventually trace the projected course of future history for the use of the Foundation."
"Exactly," said Meese dryly. "When Selden first established the Foundation, he was wise enough to include no psychologists among the scientists placed here, so that the Foundation has always worked blindly along the course of historical necessity. In the course of my researches, I have based a good deal upon hints found at the Time Vault."
"I am aware of that, Meese. It is a waste of time to repeat."
"I'm not repeating," blared Meese, "because what I'm going to tell you isn't in any of those reports."
"How do you mean? Not in the reports," said Indber stupidly.
"How could—"
"Galaxy, let me tell this my own way, you offensive little creature. Stop putting words into my mouth and questioning my every statement, or I'll tramp out of here and let everything crumble around you. Remember, you unprintable fool, the Foundation will come through because it must, but if I walk out of here now, you won't."
Dashing his hat on the floor so that clods of earth scattered, he sprang up the stairs of the dais on which the wide desk stood, and shoving papers violently, sat down upon a corner of it. Indber thought frantically of summoning the guard or using the built-in blasters of his desk. But Meese's face was glaring down upon him, and there was nothing to do but cringe the best face upon it.
"Dr. Meese," he began with weak formality, "you must—"
"Shut up," said Meese ferociously, "and listen. If this thing here," and his palm came down heavily on the metal of the bound data, "is a mess of my reports, throw it out. Any report I write goes up through some 20-odd officials, gets to you, and then sort of winds down through 20 more. That's fine if there's nothing you don't want kept secret. Well, I've got something confidential here. It's so confidential, even the boys working for me haven't got wind of it. They did the work, of course, but each just a little unconnected piece, and I put it together. You know what the Time Vault is."
Indber nodded his head, but Meese went on with loud enjoyment of the situation. "Well, I'll tell you anyhow, because I've been sort of imagining this unprintable situation for a galaxy of a long time. I can read your mind, you puny fraud.
You've got your hand right near a little knob that'll call in about 500 or so armed men to finish me off, but you're afraid of what I know. You're afraid of a Selden crisis. Besides which, if you touch anything on your desk, I'll knock your unprintable head off before anyone gets here. You and your bandit father and pirate grandfather have been blood-sucking the Foundation long enough anyway.
This is treason, gabbled Indber.
It certainly is, gloated Mies, but what are you going to do about it? Let me tell you about the Time Vault. That Time Vault is what Harry Selden placed here at the beginning to help us over the rough spots. For every crisis, Selden has prepared a personal simulacrum to help and explain. 4 crises so far, 4 appearances. The first time he appeared at the height of the first crisis. The second time he appeared at the moment just after the successful evolution of the second crisis. Our ancestors were there to listen to him both times. At the third and fourth crises, he was ignored. Probably because he was not needed, but recent investigations, not included in those reports you have, indicate that he appeared anyway and at the proper times. Get it? He did not wait for any answer. His cigar, a tattered, dead ruin, was finally disposed of, a new cigar groped for and lit. The smoke puffed out violently. He said, "Officially, I've been trying to rebuild the science of psychohistory." Well, no one man is going to do that, and it won't get done in any one century either. But I've made advances in the more simple elements, and I've been able to use it as an excuse to meddle with the Time Vault. What I have done involves the determination to a pretty fair kind of certainty of the exact date of the next appearance of Harry Selden. I can give you the exact day, in other words, that the coming Selden crisis, the 5th, will reach its climax.
How far off? Demanded Indber tensely.
And Mies exploded his bomb with cheerful nonchalance. 4 months, he said. 4 unprintable months, less 2 days.
4 months, said Indber with uncharacteristic vehemence. Impossible.
Impossible, my unprintable eye.
4 months? Do you understand what that means? For a crisis to come to a head in 4 months would mean that it has been preparing for years.
And why not? Is there a law of nature that requires the process to mature in the full light of day?
But nothing impends.
Nothing hangs over us. Indber almost wrung his hands for anxiety. With a sudden spasmodic recrudescence of ferocity, he screamed, "Will you get off my desk and let me put it in order? How do you expect me to think?"
Mies, startled, lifted heavily and moved aside.
Indber replaced objects in their appropriate niches with a feverish motion. He was speaking quickly. "You have no right to come here like this. If you had presented your theory..."
"It is not a theory."
"I say it is a theory. If you had presented it together with your evidence and arguments, in appropriate fashion, it would have gone to the Bureau of Historical Sciences. There, it could have been properly treated, the resulting analyses submitted to me, and then, of course, proper action would have been taken. As it is, you've vexed me to no purpose." "Ah, here it is."
He had a sheet of transparent, silvery paper in his hand, which he shook at the bulbous psychologist beside him.
"This is a short summary I prepare myself, weekly, of foreign matters in progress. Listen. We have completed negotiations for a commercial treaty with Mores, continue negotiations for one with Lyonnais, sent a delegation to some celebration or another on Bond, received some complaint or other from Calgan, and we've promised to look into it.
protested some sharp trade practices in Asperta, and they've promised to look into it, and so on and so on. The mayor's eyes swarmed down the list of coded notations, and then he carefully placed the sheet in its proper place in the proper folder in the proper pigeonhole. I tell you, Mies, there is not a thing there that breeds anything but order and peace. The door at the far, long end opened, and in far too dramatically coincident a fashion to suggest anything but real life, a plainly costumed notable stepped in. Indber half rose. He had the curiously swirling sensation of unreality that comes upon those days when too much happens. After Mies's intrusion and wild fumings, there now came the equally improper, hence disturbing intrusion unannounced, of his secretary, who at least knew the rules. The secretary kneeled low. Indber said sharply, "Well?" The secretary addressed the floor. "Excellence, Captain Hahn Pritcher of Information, returning from Kalgan in disobedience to your orders, has, according to prior instructions, your order X20-513, been imprisoned and awaits execution. Those accompanying him are being held for questioning. A full report has been filed." Indber, in agony, said, "A full report has been received." "Well?" "Excellence, Captain Pritcher has reported vaguely dangerous designs on the part of the new warlord of Kalgan. He has been given, according to prior instructions, your order X20-651, no formal hearing, but his remarks have been recorded and a full report filed." Indber screamed, "A full report has been received! Well?" "Excellence, reports have within the quarter hour been received from the Selinian frontier. Ships identified as Kalganian have been entering Foundation territory unauthorized. The ships are armed. Fighting has occurred." The secretary was bent nearly double. Indber remained standing. Ebling Mies shook himself, clumped up to the secretary, and tapped him sharply on the shoulder. "Here. You'd better have them release this Captain Pritcher and have him sent here. Get out." The secretary left, and Mies turned to the mayor. "Hadn't you better get the machinery moving, Indber? 4 months, you know." Indber remained standing, glaze-eyed. Only one finger seemed alive, and it traced rapid, jerky triangles on the smooth desktop before him. Chapter 16. Conference. When the 27 independent trading worlds, united only by their distrust of the mother planet of the Foundation, concert an assembly among themselves, and each is big with a pride grown of its smallness, hardened by its own insularity, and embittered by eternal danger, there are preliminary negotiations to be overcome of a pettiness sufficiently staggering to heart-sicken the most persevering. It is not enough to fix in advance such details as methods of voting, type of representation, whether by world or by population. These are matters of involved political importance. It is not enough to fix matters of priority at the table, both council and dinner. Those are matters of involved social importance. It was the place of meeting, since that was a matter of overpowering provincialism. And in the end, the devious roots of diplomacy led to the world of Radol, which some commentators had suggested at the start for logical reason of central position. Radol was a small world, and in military potential perhaps the weakest of the 27. That, by the way, was another factor in the logic of the choice. It was a ribbon world, of which the galaxy boasts sufficient, but among which the inhabited variety is a rarity, for the physical requirements are difficult to meet. It was a world, in other words, where the two halves face the monotonous extremes of heat and cold, while the region of possible life is the girdling ribbon of the Twilight Zone. Such a world invariably sounds uninviting to those who have not tried it, but there exist spots strategically placed, and Radol City was located in such a one. It spread along the soft slopes of the foothills before the hacked-out mountains that backed it along the rim of the cold hemisphere and held off the frightful ice. The warm, dry air of the sun half spilled over, and from the mountains was piped the water. And between the two, Radol City became a continuous garden, swimming in the eternal morning of an eternal June. Each house nestled among its flower garden, open to the fangless elements. Each garden was a horticultural forcing ground, where luxury plants grew in fantastic patterns for the sake of the foreign exchange they brought, until Radol had almost become a producing world rather than a typical trading world. So in its way, Radol City was a little point of softness and luxury on a horrible planet, a tiny scrap of Eden. And that, too, was a factor in the logic of the choice. The strangers came from each of the 26 other trading worlds. Delegates, wives, secretaries, newsmen, ships, and crews. And Radol's population nearly doubled, and Radol's resources strained themselves to the limit. One ate at will and drank at will and slept not at all. Yet there were few among the roisterers who were not intensely aware that all that volume of the galaxy burnt slowly in a sort of quiet, slumberous war. And of those who were aware, there were three classes. First, there were the many who knew little and were very confident. Such as the young space pilot who wore the Haven cockade on the clasp of his cap, and who managed, in holding his glass before his eyes, to catch those of the faintly smiling Radolian girl opposite. He was saying, "We came right through the war zone to get here. On purpose. We traveled about a light minute or so in neutral, right past Horligor." "Horligor?" broke in a long-legged native who was playing host to that particular gathering. "That's where the mule got the guts beat out of him last week, wasn't it?" "Where'd you hear that the mule got his guts beat out of him?" demanded the pilot loftily. "Foundation radio?" "Yeah?" "Well, the mule's got Horligor. We almost ran into a convoy of his ships, and that's where they were coming from. It isn't a gut beating when you stay where you fought, and the gut beater leaves in a hurry." Someone else said in a high, blurred voice, "Don't talk like that. Foundation always takes it on the chin for a while. You watch. Just sit back and watch. Old Foundation knows when to come back, and then pow!" The thick voice concluded and was succeeded by a bleary grin. "Anyway," said the pilot from Haven after a short pause, "as I say, we saw the mule ships, and they looked pretty good. Pretty good. I tell you what, they looked new." "New?" said the native thoughtfully. "They build them themselves?" He broke a leaf from an overhanging branch, sniffed delicately at it, then crunched it between his teeth, the bruised tissues bleeding greenly and diffusing a minty odor. He said, "You trying to tell me they beat Foundation ships with home-built jobs? Go on." "We saw them, Doc. And I can tell a ship from a comet, too, you know." The native leaned close. "You know what I think. Listen, don't kid yourself. Wars don't just start by themselves, and we have a bunch of shrewd apples running things. They know what they're doing." The well-unthirsted one said with sudden loudness, "You watch, old Foundation. They wait for the last minute, then pow!" He grinned with vacuously open mouth at the girl who moved away from him. The Radolian was saying, "For instance, old man, you think maybe that this mule guy's running things?" "No." And he wagged a finger horizontally. "The way I hear it, and from pretty high up, mind you, he's our boy. We're paying him off, and we probably built those ships. Let's be realistic about it. We probably did. Sure, he can't beat the Foundation in the long run, but he can get them shaky, and when he does, we get in.
The girl said, Is that all you can talk about, Clev? The war? You make me tired.
The pilot from Haven said, in an excess of gallantry, Change the subject. Can't make the girls tired. The bedewed one took up the refrain and banged a mug to the rhythm. The little groups of two that had formed broke up with giggles and swagger, and a few similar groups of twos emerged from the sunhouse in the background. The conversation became more general, more varied, more meaningless. Then there were those who knew a little more and were less confident, such as the one-armed Fran, whose large bulk represented Haven as official delegated, and who lived high in consequence and cultivated new friendships, with women when he could and with men when he had to. It was on the sun platform of the hilltop home of one of these new friends that he relaxed for the first of what eventually proved to be a total of 2 times while on Radol. The new friend was Iwo Leon, a kindred soul of Radol. Iwo's house was apart from the general cluster, apparently alone in a sea of floral perfume and insect chatter. The sun platform was a grassy strip of lawn set at a 45-degree angle, and upon it Fran stretched out and fairly sopped up sun. He said, Don't have anything like this on Haven. Iwo replied sleepily, Ever seen the cold side? There's a spot 20 miles from here where the oxygen runs like water. Go on.
Fact.
Well, I'll tell you, Iwo. In the old days before my arm was chewed off, I knocked around, see? And you won't believe this, but... The story that followed lasted considerably, and Iwo didn't believe it. Iwo said through yawns, They don't make them like in the old days, that's the truth.
No, guess they don't.
Well, now, Fran fired up, don't say that. I told you about my son, didn't I? He's one of the old school, if you like. He'll make a great traitor, blast it. He's his old man up and down. Up and down. Except that he gets married.
You mean legal contract? With a girl?
That's right. Don't see the sense in it myself. They went to Calgan for their honeymoon.
Calgan? Calgan? When the galaxy was this?
Fran smiled broadly and said with slow meaning, Just before the mule declared war on the Foundation.
That's so.
Fran nodded and motioned Iwo closer with his head. He said hoarsely, In fact, I can tell you something if you don't let it go any further. My boy was sent to Calgan for a purpose. Now, I wouldn't like to let it out, you know, just what the purpose was, naturally. But you look at the situation now, and I suppose you can make a pretty good guess. In any case, my boy was the man for the job. We traitors needed some sort of ruckus.
He smiled craftily.
It's here. I'm not saying how we did it, but my boy went to Calgan and the mule sent out his ships. My son.
Iwo was duly impressed. He grew confidential in his turn.
That's good. You know, they say we've got 500 ships ready to pitch in on our own at the right time.
Fran said authoritatively, More than that, maybe. This is real strategy. This is the kind I like.
He clawed loudly at the skin of his abdomen. But don't you forget that the mule is a smart boy, too. What happened at Harligore worries me.
I heard he lost about 10 ships.
Sure, but he had 100 more, and the Foundation had to get out. It's all to the good to have those tyrants beaten, but not as quickly as all that.
He shook his head. The question I ask
is where does the mule get his ships? There's a widespread rumor we are making them for him.
We? The traders?
Haven has the biggest ship factories anywhere in the independent worlds, and we haven't made one for anyone but ourselves. Do you suppose any world is building a fleet for the mule on its own? Without taking the precaution of united action? That's a fairy tale.
Well, where does he get them?
And Fran shrugged. Makes them himself, I suppose. That worries me, too.
Fran blinked at the sun and curled his toes about the smooth wood of the polished footrest. Slowly he fell asleep, and the soft burr of his breathing mingled with the insect sibilance. Lastly, there were the very few who knew considerable and were not confident at all, such as Randu, who on the fifth day of the All-Trader Convention entered the central hall and found the two men he had asked to be there waiting for him. The 500 seats were empty and were going to stay so. Randu said quickly, almost before he sat down, "We three represent about half the military potential of the independent trading worlds."
"Yes," said Mangan of Iss. "My colleague and I have already commented upon the fact."
"I am ready," said Randu, "to speak quickly and earnestly. I am not interested in bargaining or subtlety. Our position is radically in the worse."
"As a result of," urged Oval Gree of Nemen,
"of developments of the last hour, please, from the beginning. First, our position is not of our doing, and but doubtfully of our control. Our original dealings were not with the mule, but with several others, notably the ex-warlord of Kalgan, whom the mule defeated at a most inconvenient time for us."
"Yes, but this mule is a worthy substitute," said Mangan.
"I do not cavil at details."
"You may when you know all the details."
Randu leaned forward and placed his hands upon the table, palms up, in an obvious gesture. He said, "A month ago, I sent my nephew and my nephew's wife to Kalgan."
"Your nephew?" cried Oval Gree in surprise. "I did not know he was your nephew."
"With what purpose?" asked Mangan dryly.
"This?"
And his thumb drew an inclusive circle high in the air.
"No. If you mean the mule's war on the Foundation, no. How could I aim so high? The young man knew nothing, neither of our organization nor of our aims. He was told I was a minor member of an intra-haven patriotic society, and his function at Kalgan was nothing but that of an amateur observer. My motives were, I must admit, rather obscure. Mainly, I was curious about the mule. He is a strange phenomenon. But that's a chewed cud. I'll not go into it. Secondly, it would make an interesting and educational training project for a man who had experience with the Foundation and the Foundation underground and showed promise of future usefulness to us. You see..."
Oval's long face fell into vertical lines as he showed his large teeth.
"You must have been surprised at the outcome, then, since there is not a world among the traders, I believe, that does not know that this nephew of yours abducted a mule underling in the name of the Foundation and furnished the mule with a casus belli. Galaxy, Randu, you spin romances. I find it hard to believe you had no hand in that. Come, it was a skillful job."
Randu shook his white head. "Not of my doing. Nor willfully of my nephew's, who is now held prisoner at the Foundation, and may not live to see the completion of this so skillful job. I have just heard from him. The personal capsule has been smuggled out somehow, come through the war zone, gone to Haven, and traveled from there to here. It has been a month on its travels."
"And?"
Randu leaned a heavy hand upon the heel of his palm and said, sadly, "I'm afraid we are cast for the same role that the one-time warlord of Kalgan played. The mule
is a mutant. There was a momentary qualm, a faint impression of quickened heartbeats. Randu might easily have imagined it. When Mangan spoke, the evenness of his voice was unchanged.
How do you know?
Only because my nephew says so, but he was on Kalgan.
What kind of a mutant? There are all kinds, you know.
Randu forced the rising impatience down. All kinds of mutants, yes, Mangan. All kinds. But only one kind of mule. What kind of a mutant would start as an unknown, assemble an army, establish, they say, a 5-mile asteroid as original base, capture a planet, then a system, then a region, and then attack the Foundation and defeat them at Horlagor, and all in 2 or 3 years?
Oval Gris shrugged.
So you think he'll beat the Foundation? I don't know. Suppose he does. Sorry, I can't go that far. You don't beat the Foundation. Look, there's not a new fact we have to go on except for the statements of a... well, of an inexperienced boy. Suppose we shelve it for a while. With all the mule's victories, we weren't worried until now, and unless he goes a good deal further than he has, I see no reason to change that. Yes?
Randu frowned and despaired at the cobweb texture of his argument. He said to both, "Have we yet made any contact with the mule?"
"No," both answered. "It's true, though, that we've tried, isn't it? It's true that there's not much purpose to our meeting unless we do reach him, isn't it? It's true that so far there's been more drinking than thinking, and more wooing than doing. I quote from an editorial in today's Radol Tribune, and all because we can't reach the mule. Gentlemen, we have nearly 1,000 ships waiting to be thrown into the fight at the proper moment to seize control of the Foundation. I say we should change that. I say throw those 1,000 onto the board now, against the mule."
"You mean for the tyrant Indber and the bloodsuckers of the Foundation?" demanded Mangan with quiet venom.
Randu raised a weary hand. "Spare me the adjectives. Against the mule, I say, and for I don't care who."
Oval Gris rose. "Randu, I'll have nothing to do with that. You present it to the full council tonight if you particularly hunger for political suicide."
He left without another word, and Mangan followed silently, leaving Randu to drag out a lonely hour of endless, insoluble consideration. At the full council that night, he said nothing. But it was Oval Gris who pushed into his room the next morning, an Oval Gris only sketchily dressed and who had neither shaved nor combed his hair. Randu stared at him over a yet uncleared breakfast table with an astonishment sufficiently open and strenuous to cause him to drop his pipe. Oval said baldly, harshly, "Nemun has been bombarded from space by treacherous attack."
Randu's eyes narrowed. "The Foundation?"
"The mule," exploded Oval. "The mule!" His words raced. "It was unprovoked and deliberate. Most of our fleet had joined the International Flotilla. The few left as home squadron were insufficient and were blown out of the sky. There have been no landings yet, and there may not be, for half the attackers are reported destroyed. But it is war. And I've come to ask how Haven stands on the matter."
"Haven, I am sure, will adhere to the spirit of the Charter of Federation. But you see, he attacks us as well. This mule is a madman. Can he defeat the universe?"
He faltered and sat down to seize Randu's wrist. "Our few survivors have reported the mule's enemies' possession of a new weapon. A nuclear field depressor."
"A what?"
Oval said, Most of our ships were lost because their nuclear weapons failed them. It could not have happened by either accident or sabotage. It must have been a weapon of the Mule. It didn't work perfectly. The effect was intermittent. There were ways to neutralize. My dispatches are not detailed, but you see that such a tool would change the nature of war and possibly make our entire fleet obsolete.
Randu felt an old, old man. His face sagged hopelessly.
I am afraid a monster is grown that will devour all of us. Yet we must fight him.
Chapter 17. The Visisoner. Ebling Mises' house in a not-so-pretentious neighborhood of Terminus City was well known to the intelligentsia, literati, and just plain well-read of the Foundation. Its notable characteristics depended subjectively upon the source material that was read. To a thoughtful biographer, it was the symbolization of a retreat from a non-academic reality. A society columnist gushed silkily at its frightfully masculine atmosphere of careless disorder. A university PhD called it brusquely bookish, but unorganized. A non-university friend said, good for a drink any time, and you can put your feet on the sofa. And a breezy Newsweekly broadcast that went in for color spoke of the rocky, down-to-earth, no-nonsense living quarters of blaspheming, leftish, balding Ebling Mies. To Beta, who thought for no audience but herself at the moment, and who had the advantage of first-hand information, it was merely sloppy. Except for the first few days, her imprisonment had been a light burden. Far lighter, it seemed, than this half-hour wait in the psychologist's home, under secret observation, perhaps. She had been with Torin then, at least. Perhaps she might have grown wearier of the strain had not Magnifico's long nose drooped in a gesture that plainly showed his own far greater tension. Magnifico's pipe-stem legs were folded up under a pointed, sagging chin, as if he were trying to huddle himself into disappearance, and Beta's hand went out in a gentle and automatic gesture of reassurance. Magnifico winced, then smiled. Surely, my lady, it would seem that even yet my body denies the knowledge of my mind and expects of others' hands a blow. There's no need for worry, Magnifico. I'm with you, and I won't let anyone hurt you. The clown's eyes sidled towards her, then drew away quickly.
But they kept me away from you earlier, and from your kind husband. And on my word, you may laugh, but I was lonely for missing friendship.
I wouldn't laugh at that. I was too. The clown brightened, and he hugged his knees closer.
He said, you have not met this man who will see us?
It was a cautious question.
No, but he is a famous man. I have seen him in the newscasts and heard quite a good deal of him. I think he's a good man, Magnifico, who means us no harm.
Yes, the clown stirred uneasily.
That may be, my lady, but he has questioned me before, and his manner is of an abruptness and loudness that bequivers me. He is full of strange words, so that the answers to his questions could not worm out of my throat. Almost I might believe the romancer who once played on my ignorance with a tale that, at such moments, the heart lodged in the windpipe and prevented speech. But it's different now. We're two to his one, and he won't be able to frighten the both of us, will he? No, my lady.
A door slammed somewheres, and the roaring of a voice entered the house. Just outside the room it coagulated into words with a fierce, "Get the galaxy out of here!" and two uniformed guards were momentarily visible through the opening door, in quick retreat. Ebling Mies entered frowning, deposited a carefully wrapped bundle on the floor, and approached to shake Beta's hand with careless pressure. Beta returned it vigorously, man-fashion. Mies did a double-take as he turned to the clown and favored the girl with a longer look. He said, "Married?"
Yes, we went through the legal formalities. Meese paused. Then, happy about it? So far. Meese shrugged and turned again to Magnifico. He unwrapped the package. Know what this is, boy? Magnifico fairly hurled himself out of his seat and caught the multi-keyed instrument. He fingered the myriad knobby contacts and threw a sudden back somersault of joy to the imminent destruction of the nearby furniture. He croaked, a Visi sonar, and of a make to distill joy out of a dead man's heart. His long fingers caressed softly and slowly, pressing lightly on contacts with a rippling motion, resting momentarily on one key, then another. And in the air before them, there was a soft, glowing rosiness just inside the range of vision. Ebling Meese said, all right, boy, you said you could pound on one of those gadgets, and there's your chance. You'd better tune it, though. It's out of a museum. Then, in an aside to Beta, near as I can make it, no one on the Foundation can make it talk right. He leaned closer and said quickly, the clown won't talk without you. Will you help? She nodded. Good, he said. His state of fear is almost fixed, and I doubt that his mental strength would possibly stand a psychic probe. If I'm to get anything out of him otherwise, he's got to feel absolutely at ease. You understand? She nodded again. This Visi sonar is the first step in the process. He says he can play it, and his reaction now makes it pretty certain that it's one of the great joys of his life. So whether the playing is good or bad, be interested and appreciative. Then exhibit friendliness and confidence in me. Above all, follow my lead in everything. There was a swift glance at Magnifico, huddled in a corner of the sofa, making rapid adjustments in the interior of the instrument. He was completely absorbed. Meese said in a conversational tone to Beta, ever hear of Visi sonar? Once, said Beta, equally casually, at a concert of rare instruments. I wasn't impressed. Well, I doubt that you came across good playing. There are very few really good players. It's not so much that it requires physical coordination. A multi-bank piano requires more, for instance, as a certain type of free-wheeling mentality. In a lower voice, that's why our living skeleton there might be better than we think. More often than not, good players are idiots otherwise. It's one of those queer setups that make psychology interesting. He added, in a patent effort to manufacture light conversation, you know how the blistered thing works? I looked it up for this purpose, and all I've made out so far is that its radiations stimulate the optic center of the brain directly, without ever touching the optic nerve. It's actually the utilization of a sense never met with in ordinary nature. Remarkable when you come to think of it. What you hear is all right. That's ordinary. Eardrum, cochlea, all that. But, shh, he's ready. Will you kick that switch? It works better in the dark. In the darkness, Magnifico was a mere blob, Ebling Meese a heavy breathing mass. Beta found herself straining her eyes anxiously, and at first with no effect. There was a thin, reedy quaver in the air that wavered raggedly up the scale. It hovered, dropped, and caught itself, gained in body, and swooped into a booming crash that had the effect of a thunderous split in a veiling curtain. A little globe of pulsing color grew in rhythmic spurts and burst in midair into formless gouts that swirled high and came down as curving streamers in interlacing patterns. They coalesced into little spheres, no two alike in color, and Beta began discovering things. She noticed that closing her eyes made the color pattern all the clearer, that each little movement of color had its own little pattern of sound, that she could not identify the colors, and lastly, that the globes were not globes, but little figures. Little figures, little shifting flames that danced and flickered in their myriads, that dropped out of sight and returned from nowhere, that whipped about one another and coalesced then into a new color. Incongruously, Beta thought of the little blobs of color that come at night when you close your eyelids till they hurt and stare patiently. There was the old familiar effect of the marching polka dots of shifting color, of the contracting concentric circles, of the shapeless masses that quiver momentarily. All that, larger, multivariate, and each little dot of color, a tiny figure. They darted at her in pairs, and she lifted her hands with a sudden gasp, but they tumbled, and for an instant she was the center of a brilliant snowstorm, while cold light slipped off her shoulders and down her arm in a luminous ski slide, shooting off her stiff fingers and meeting slowly in a shining mid-air focus. Beneath it all, the sound of 100 instruments flowed in liquid streams until she could not tell it from the light. She wondered if Ebling Mies were seeing the same thing, and if not, what he did see. The wonder passed, and then she was watching again. The little figures. Were they little figures? Little tiny women with burning hair that turned and bent too quickly for the mind to focus, seized one another in star-shaped groups that turned, and the music was faint laughter, girls' laughter that began inside the ear. The stars drew together, sparked toward one another, grew slowly into structure, and from below, a palace shot upward in rapid evolution. Each brick a tiny color, each color a tiny spark, each spark a stabbing light that shifted patterns and led the eye skyward to 20 jeweled minarets. A glittering carpet shot out and about, whirling, spinning an insubstantial web that engulfed all space, and from it, luminous shoots stabbed upward and branched into trees that sang with a music all their own. Beta sat enclosed in it. The music welled about her in rapid, lyrical flights. She reached out to touch a fragile tree, and blossoming spicules floated downwards and faded, each with its clear, tiny tinkle. The music crashed in 20 cymbals, and before her an area flamed up in a spout and cascaded down invisible steps into Beta's lap, where it spilled over and flowed in rapid current, raising the fiery sparkle to her waist, while across her lap was a rainbow bridge, and upon it the little figures. A palace, and a garden, and tiny men and women on a bridge, stretching out as far as she could see, swimming through the stately swells of stringed music converging in upon her. And then there seemed a frightened pause, a hesitant, indrawn motion, a swift collapse. The colors fled, spun into a globe that shrank and rose and disappeared, and it was merely dark again. A heavy foot scratched for the pedal, reached it, and the light flooded in, the flat light of a prosy sun. Beta blinked until the tears came, as though for the longing of what was gone. Ebling Mies was a podgy inertness, with his eyes still round and his mouth still open. Only Magnifico himself was alive, and he fondled his visisonar in a crooning ecstasy. "My lady," he gasped, "it is indeed of an effect the most magical. It is of balance and response almost beyond hope in its delicacy and stability. On this, it would seem I could work wonders. How liked you my composition, my lady?"
"Was it yours?"
breathed Beta.
"Your own?"
At her awe, his thin face turned a glowing red to the tip of his mighty nose. "My very own, my lady. The mule liked it not, but often and often I have played it for my own amusement. It was once in my youth that I saw the palace, a gigantic place of jeweled riches that I saw from a distance at a time of high carnival. There were people of a splendor undreamed of, and magnificence more than ever I saw afterwards, even in the mule service. It is but a poor makeshift I have created, but my mind's poverty precludes more. I call it the memory of heaven. Now, through the midst of the chatter, Mies shook himself to active life. "Here," he said, "here, Magnifico. Would you like to do that same thing for others?" For a moment, the clown drew back.
"For others?" he quavered.
"For thousands," cried Mies, "in the great halls of the Foundation. Would you like to be your own master and honored by all, wealthy and... His imagination failed him. "And all that? Eh? What do you say?"
"But how may I be all that, mighty sir, for indeed I am but a poor clown ungiven to the great things of the world."
The psychologist puffed out his lips and passed the back of his hand across his brow. He said, "But you're playing, man. The world is yours if you would play so for the mayor and his trading trusts. Wouldn't you like that?" The clown glanced briefly at Beta.
"Would she stay with me?"
Beta laughed.
"Of course, silly. Would it be likely that I'd leave you now that you're on the point of becoming rich and famous?"
"It would all be yours," he replied earnestly. "And surely the wealth of galaxy itself would be yours before I could repay my debt to your kindness." "But," said Mies casually, "if you would first help me..."
"What is that?"
The psychologist paused and smiled. "A little surface probe that doesn't hurt. It wouldn't touch but the peel of your brain." There was a flare of deadly fear in Magnifico's eyes.
"Not a probe. I have seen it used. It drains the mind and leaves an empty skull.
The mule did use it upon traitors and let them wander mindless through the streets until out of mercy they were killed." He held up his hand to push Mies away. "That was a psychic probe," explained Mies patiently, "and even that would only harm a person when misused. This probe I have is a surface probe that wouldn't hurt a baby."
"That's right, Magnifico," urged Beta. "It's only to help beat the mule and keep him far away. Once that's done, you and I will be rich and famous all our lives."
Magnifico held out a trembling hand.
"Will you hold my hand, then?"
Beta took it in both her own, and the clown watched the approach of the burnished terminal plates with large eyes. Ebling Mies rested carelessly on the too lavish chair in Mayor Indber's private quarters, unregenerately unthankful for the condescension shown him, and watched the small mayors fidgeting unsympathetically. He tossed away a cigar stub and spat out a shred of tobacco. "And incidentally, if you want something for your next concert at Mallow Hall, Indber," he said, "you can dump out those electronic gadgeteers into the sewers they came from and have this little freak play the visisonar for you. Indber, it's out of this world." Indber said peevishly, "I did not call you here to listen to your lectures on music."
"What of the mule?"
"Tell me that. What of the mule?"
"The mule?
Well, I'll tell you. I used a surface probe and got little. Can't use the psychic probe because the freak is scared blind of it, so that his resistance will probably blow his unprintable mental fuses as soon as contact is made. But this is what I've got, if you'll just stop tapping your fingernails. First place, de-stress the mule's physical strength. He's probably strong, but most of the freak's fairy tales about it are probably considerably blown up by his own fearful memory. He wears queer glasses, and his eyes kill. He evidently has mental powers. So much we had at the start, commented the mayor sourly.
Then the probe confirms it, and from there on I've been working mathematically.
So, and how long will all this take? Your word rattling will deafen me yet.
About a month, I should say, and I may have something for you.
And I may not, of course.
But what of it? If this is all outside Selden's plans, our chances are precious little. Unprintable little.
Indber whirled on the psychologist fiercely.
Now I have you, traitor.
Lie.
Say you're not one of these criminal rumor mongers that are spreading defeatism and panic through the Foundation and making my work doubly hard.
I? Meese gathered anger slowly.
Inber swore at him. Because by the dust clouds of space, the Foundation will win. The Foundation must win.
Despite the loss at Horligor,
it was not a loss.
You have swallowed that spreading lie, too?
We were outnumbered and betreasoned.
By whom? Demanded Meese contemptuously.
By the lice-ridden Democrats of the gutter, shouted Inver back at him.
I have known for long that the fleet has been riddled by Democratic cells.
Most have been wiped out, but enough remain for the unexplained surrender of 20 ships in the thickest of the swarming fight.
Enough to force an apparent defeat.
For that matter, my rough-tongued, simple patriot and epitome of the primitive virtues, what are your own connections with the Democrats?
Ebling Meese shrugged it off.
You rave. Do you know that?
What of the retreat since and the loss of half of Siwena?
Democrats again?
No, not Democrats. The little man smiled sharply.
We retreat, as the Foundation has always retreated under attack, until the inevitable march of history turns with us.
Already I see the outcome. Already the so-called underground of the Democrats has issued manifestos swearing aid and allegiance to the government.
It could be a feint, a cover for a deeper treachery, but I make good use of it, and the propaganda distilled from it will have its effect, whatever the crawling traitor's scheme.
And better than that.
Even better than that, Inver.
Judge for yourself. 2 days ago, the so-called Association of Independent Traders declared war on the Mule, and the Foundation fleet is strengthened at a stroke by 1,000 ships. You see, this Mule goes too far. He finds us divided and quarreling among ourselves, and under the pressure of his attack, we unite and grow strong.
He must lose. It is inevitable, as always.
Meese still exuded skepticism.
Then you tell me that Selden planned even for the fortuitous occurrence of a mutant.
A mutant.
I can't tell him from a human, nor could you, but for the ravings of a rebel captain, some outland youngsters, and an addled juggler and clown. You forget the most conclusive evidence of all.
Your own.
My own?
For just a moment, Meese was startled.
Your own, sneered the mayor. The time vault opens in 9 weeks.
What of that?
It opens for a crisis. If this attack of the Mule is not the crisis, where is the real one, the one the vault is opening for? Answer me, you lardish ball.
The psychologist shrugged.
All right, if it keeps you happy.
Do me a favor, though.
Just in case. Just in case old Selden makes his speech and it does go sour. Suppose you let me attend the grand opening.
All right. Get out of here. And stay out of my sight for 9 weeks. With unprintable pleasure, you wizened horror, muttered Meese to himself as he left.
Chapter 18. Fall of the Foundation. There was an atmosphere about the time.